I'm Amy Hall, and you're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRask podcast. Here with me today is Greg Kokel. And
yeah,
this is.
Yeah, imagine that. Surprise, surprise.
As always. And this is the show where we take your questions from Twitter, or you can send them through our website with the hashtag STRask, and then we talk about the answers. So today, since tomorrow is the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, I have a couple of questions about abortion. So the first one comes from C4 The Truth. I was charged with having an inconsistent view. Is it inconsistent to believe that all life is sacred, God's image, yet believe that it is morally justified to end a life in the womb to save the mother?
First of all, just an observation. Inconsistency is a flaw in thinking. So it's an individual intellectual vice. Being inconsistent does not change the reality of some particular view one is defending inconsistently. So if it turns out that a pro-lifer is inconsistent in applying their views, that doesn't mean that the view regarding abortion is a bad one. It just means for some reason they are not carrying the logic through. All right. Now, I think sometimes the charge of inconsistency is a legitimate challenge because it seems like people are playing fast and loose and they are special pleading certain circumstances in their favor and other ones in a different way by a different standard, all right? And so what that allows us to do then is to look more closely at whether the case being made initially that one is acting inconsistently with is a good case. If it turns out that the case is a good one and stands on its own two feet in terms of its moral conclusions about it, well, then the charge of inconsistency is only a charge of intellectual vice on behalf of the person making the argument. It is not a charge against the original view that is well justified, which in this case is the importance of individual human lives, the value of them, and what justifications we have in taking them. All right. Now, what's interesting in this particular case is when properly described, and sometimes people are not in a good position to kind of vet this challenge well, but our case is that human beings are valuable, infinitely valuable, made in the image of God. Our case is not, the pro-life case is not that we are in favor of all life. Pro-life is just shorthand for saying it is wrong to take the life of an innocent human being for the reasons people give for abortion, generally speaking. So classically, pro-lifers are also in favor of capital punishment. And the reason we're in favor of that is because there is a taking of human life that is justified by common sense legal thinking and also by God's command. It was one of the earliest commands he gave. It was in the book of Genesis, chapter 9. And then in the Mosaic law, there are dozens of crimes that are capital crimes. So the question is whether the taking of human life is justified. In abortion, the answer is, in virtually every circumstance, no. Now, in the case of a mother's life genuinely being in jeopardy, and by the way, that's hardly ever the case, but when the mother's life is genuinely in jeopardy, now what you're facing generally is the loss of two lives, the baby's life because the mother dies and the mother's life because the mother dies. All right. Now, there can be some exceptions where the mother dies and the baby survives, but then it's one life over another. All right. So the thing is, you in either case, you're going to have a corpse. And in the case of a mother's life being in jeopardy, the decision is to save as many lives as possible because both human lives are valuable. Now, there's two ways to construe value. One is intrinsic value, and it doesn't matter whether a baby is a fetus or the president of the United States. They still have the same intrinsic value in themselves. But there's also instrumental value, that is, additional value that's based on circumstances that is significant. And so a mother has more instrumental value than the unborn child because the mother is involved in relationships, maybe has other children and responsibilities and people she's taking care of. And so there is more loss of value if the mother dies than if the baby dies. Same loss of intrinsic value, but an additional loss of instrumental value because of the role that the mother already is currently playing in the lives of so many other people, okay? So this is one of those tragic moral, it's not exactly a moral dilemma, but you're facing, let's put it this way, you are facing a decision that when each side of the dilemma is taken in isolation, the answer would be clear. Don't kill either one. But when they're combined in a difficult moral conflict, then you have to make a decision. And I'm stipulating here, again, that this is when the mother's life is genuinely in danger. Many times when this decision is made, the woman's life is not in danger. Maybe her health might be in danger. Maybe her well-being or her job or something like that might be in danger. And so people elevate that to the level of the value of the unborn child's life. But that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about life for life in this case. And when it's life for life, then you have to make a decision. And the decision is meant to, first, save as many lives as possible. If you do nothing, likely both will die. If you do nothing, maybe only one will die, but in neither case you're going to have a corpse. And so if you make a decision, then you want the one to live who has the most total value. Notice that I'm making the decision now in a way that's completely consistent with the moral logic of the pro-life view. It is not inconsistent in the slightest bit when one is careful about seeing the moral details here. We're not just saying it's okay to not to kill in this case, but it's okay to kill in this case. Oh, and we value all life, so in the second case we are not valuing the life we say we value, therefore we're being inconsistent. That is a sloppy, cavalier way of approaching the issue. Properly understanding the pro-life view acknowledges the full value of each human being involved in the process, and the greatest good being accomplished with saving as many lives as possible. And when it's one or the other. Let's just say the mother might die even though the baby could survive. And in the past, and you know, back in the day, that used to happen. The mother would die in childbirth, the baby would be okay. Too much stress for the mother's body. But in that case, you have now a child and a loss of a mother who creates other additional losses that the loss of the child would not have created. And this is why when you have the option, and we do now so medically, then we are willing to take the life of the child in an abortion to save the life of the mother. But many will point out, by the way, that that's not even really an abortion, because even though the child's life is taken, the moral circumstances are so different and so unique that it would be inappropriate to call it abortion, having all the moral freight that word implies. There is a law in ethics, an ethical principle called the law of double effect. And that is, sometimes you know that the consequence of a decision you're going to make is going to be bad. though you do not intend the consequence, you are willing to live with the consequence because of the greater good that is accomplished through the decision you make. Classic example, D-Day. Tens of thousands of civilians died on D-Day because of the advanced bombing of the Allies on the Normandy coast. But that was necessary in order to have the landing that then ended up liberating the continent. Now, nobody intended to kill civilians. They intended to either kill Germans or to blow up their defenses. But they knew the consequence would be, the collateral damage would be, that civilians would die. That's the law of double effect. Fully acknowledging civilians' value, but seeing that this is going to be the necessary consequence of the larger good that is meant to be accomplished.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to note, Greg, that in cases where the mother's life is in danger and saving her would result in the death of the child, usually that means that direct actions are taken to save the mother, which then result in the death of the child, not as a direct result, but as an indirect result. So yeah, say exactly. Someone, say that a mother has cancer and she wants to have treatment, but the treatment will result in the death of the baby. Well, they're not setting out to kill the baby. They're setting out to save the mother. And unfortunately, exactly. The result is the death of the baby.
And that's a great characterization of the law of double effect, because the effect that you're trying to have, the main goal, the intention is to do this good thing, even though you know there's going to be a negative consequence. And that's a good illustration.
But I also want to note here, in case someone thinks that you're saying that we must always choose the mother over the child. I also think there is a sense where mothers will choose to die for their baby. Mm, and that happens. That does happen. I mean, that, you know, how many mothers will save for their born children? Oh, I would die for that child.
Of course.
There is some sort of also, there is something beautiful about a mother dying for a child. And some do decide to do that. You read stories about women who do have cancer and then don't have the treatment so mm-hmm. that their baby can live. And that's a perfectly good thing to do. I don't know that I would say it's morally required. I would say it probably goes above and beyond.
Exactly.
And is commendable.
Right. They call that a supererogatory act, mm-hmm. a heroic act above and beyond the call of duty. And what's very interesting about many of those cases where the mother says, and remember, Jesus said, no greater love has man than this, that he lay down his life for a friend. And this is what's going on here. The mother's willing to lay down her life for the child. It turns out there's lots of cases when neither die. Mm-hmm. And so the prognosis has not been accurate. And this is why I stipulated earlier, even if we knew for sure this was the case, then we are totally justified following consistently the moral logic of the pro-life view in treating the mother even though it endangered the life of the child. And that's the point you're making.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go on to the next question. This one comes from Alice. In the December 7th hashtag STR Ask, when you talked about God regulating something he hates, divorce, it reminded me of people defending abortion laws because it regulates something bad to avoid something worse, death from back alley abortions. Can you talk about why it's different?
Yeah, there's a huge difference. Okay, so let's just look at it historically. It is well known now that the alleged number of so-called back alley abortions, and these are non-professionals. I mean, the classic picture is a coat hanger technique. Non-professionals that are putting women at risk to accomplish abortions that they were not able to get legally. Now, this happened. There's no question about that. But the number was radically inflated by the pro-abortion movement. And this has been acknowledged for a long time. All right. So that's one part of it. This doesn't happen as much as one thinks. But some might think, well, isn't saving one mother's life worth the thing? Is it worth legalizing abortion to keep them from doing that? And the answer is, when you legalize abortion, you guarantee the loss of life of the child. I mean, if you want to say saving one life, well, what you've done is you've, in a circular fashion, presumed that the unborn is not a valuable human being on par with the mother. And so what you do is in order to save some human life, in the so-called back alley abortion, you are justifying a massive loss of human life through abortion on demand. When I say abortion on demand, that's not rhetoric. That's the law. Okay? And incidentally, to put this in perspective, we are rattles me to think that unless a person is about 22 years old, they have no recollection of 9/11. Because it happened 20 years ago, and you know, you had to be 4 or 5 years old to be able. But in 9/11, we lost 2,977 people in one fell swoop in one day on American soil, and it was so tragic it buckled our knees emotionally. But that's the number of children that die virtually every single day through legal abortion in the United States, day upon day. Now, for what, 48 years? Okay, so we have a massive number of bodies. How would people even react emotionally if they had the same kind of response to abortion as they do 9/11? Okay, and if we say, you know, well, we can live with the 9/11, because if we didn't have a 9/11, then, you know, a couple of other people's lives might have been saved. Save for the circumstance of 9/11. But look at all those people who died. And see, that's if you're just looking at body counts, which the argument seems to suggest, well, the greater good is protecting the life of the mother in this circumstance. Well, the body counts is there's no comparison. All right. And now a couple of other things here. And one of them is the whole approach is very patronizing to women. Because it does not properly acknowledge the legitimacy of a woman's choice. The way this canard is usually characterized is that women would be forced to go into back alley abortions. They're being dragged, kicking and screaming, you know. No, they're not being forced at all. They are making an adult choice to end their pregnancy in a dangerous way, all right? Why is that anybody else's fault but theirs? I understand it's a hard circumstance. I'm not downplaying that at all. But if our view is, like the women's movement, is women are, you know, capable deciders about their own fate, then let them decide. Don't treat them like children by saying we must protect them from doing something stupid. All right. And the last thing is, even if Roe v. Wade was overturned, there wouldn't be any back alley abortions. And the reason is, there would still be illegal abortions, but they wouldn't be in the back alley. And I'll tell you why, because almost half a century, there's been legal abortions all over the country in every single state. That means there's all kinds of legal equipment out there. Good, healthy for the mother. Means of taking the life of her unborn child. She doesn't need a coat hanger. And there's going to be plenty of doctors that are going to be willing to provide an abortion for that woman. You know, it's like a speakeasy. You know, it may be illegal, but there's going to be illegal abortions happening by doctors who are fully qualified with equipment capable of doing that. Now, incidentally, that doesn't mean it's going to be safe for mom. Because even legal abortions right now by doctors under the circumstances are dangerous. And this is a dirty little secret that we only learn through expose documentaries, as some might recall. But nevertheless, it's it's a it it is a It turns out to be a kind of twisted moral logic when you look at the entire picture to say that we have to allow legal abortions that kill thousands of people a day in order to prevent some women, a handful of women each year, doing something foolish and sacrificing their lives in the process.
Greg, that point you just made about abortions being unsafe even when they're legal, the irony is that the people who might make this argument would also oppose any sort of regulation to make it safer for women, even in legal abortions. Mm-hmm. They oppose regulations that will require certain safety standards and for the doctor, for the, you know, everything. And so it does seem a little ironic.
Well, the reason is because it restricts the trade. And that's what this is about. It's about the trade. It's about cranking women through the abortion mill and picking up the financial tab or gaining from the financially from it. And that's why they don't want any further restrictions, because that's going to diminish the number. And they hide behind all of these, as I mentioned earlier, canards, these foolish challenges that have rhetorical power but no substance.
And beyond that, I do have a couple things to say about the difference between this and the laws for divorce, since I was the one who brought up the idea that
it's all your
that
fault.
God regulated divorce to avoid to mitigate the problems with it. But my first point is that it's not so much that it's avoiding something worse; it's that it's mitigating the damage that divorce does, and in particular, the damage it does to the injured party, which in this case would be the woman. I don't think they were able to initiate divorces. I'm not actually sure about that. But mm-hmm. I think in general, it would be the man dismissing the woman. And what having legal regulations around that did is it made people accountable for initiating divorce, and it protected the injured party. It made a way for the woman to be free to get legally married again afterward, as she would need to do in that culture. So the divorce laws weren't intended to make divorce easier so that the offending party would have an easier time getting a mm-hmm. divorce. It was intended to mitigate the damage that the offending party would do. Mm-hmm. So the abortion laws are something different. They're there to enable the offender, the one who's killing an innocent human being, to have an easier time killing that human being. They're there to make it easier to do something God hates, not to make it more difficult. And they're there to make it so that she has less risk to herself. They're not there to mitigate the damage to the innocent mm-hmm. party, the human beings in the womb. They're making those killings possible. So I think that's a big difference, number one. And number two, and I think you touched on this, Greg, when Alice asked, you know, does it regulate something bad to avoid something worse? I'm not sure I would say that suffering as a consequence of killing a human being is worse than killing a human being. So even if we're talking about allowing something bad in order to avoid something worse, I would say that the reasoning flows in the opposite direction. We understand that if it is the case that women would very lamentably choose to have illegal abortions and die from that, that's a terrible thing, and they die as a result of killing their child. But we still ought to have laws against abortion, because the murder of innocent human beings is worse than that. So it's actually the opposite. Hmm. We are trying to mitigate damage. And let's say that so if you compared it to divorce, it would be more like, okay, we know women are going to try to kill their unborn children. How do we mitigate the damage of that? Well, we make it illegal. We make it harder for her to do it. We make it. We try and stop the damage to the injured party, which is the child. So, mm-hmm. I think you have it backwards. What is bad avoiding something worse? Because we are regulating something bad to avoid something worse, and the something worse is the killing of the child. So the bad thing would be a woman dying in illegal abortions. We all agree that's bad. Mm-hmm. But it's worse to freely be able to kill all the mm-hmm. any child that you want.
Now, we've been talking about this issue and appropriately, I think, in a kind of dispassionate ethical fashion. What's right and what's wrong? Now, that doesn't mean that we are not sympathetic either to the plight of a woman facing an unplanned abortion. Every one of my three children were the result of an unplanned abortion. I mean, unplanned pregnancy. I'm sorry, unplanned pregnancy was the. Every one of my children is the result of an unplanned pregnancy. My wife was a single mom, and then we adopted two children from other unplanned pregnancies. Fortunately, in each of those cases, they chose life for their children, and this is why we have magnificent children to live with, even though it cost the mother a lot to give the child out for adoption. It's incalculable the pain that is a part of that process of giving away your child. So, but the alternative, of course, is killing the child. And for some reason, some people think that's a better choice than going through the pain of giving their child up. My wife heard this all the time when she was counseling in these circumstances. But we are sympathetic to that. It is that and this is why we have pro-life organizations and we have crisis pregnancy centers and we donate our family donates and I speak for these organizations in order to raise funds for those. So we care about that. But we also care about women who are ones who have had abortions and are facing the emotional pain of that. And Amy, maybe you want to say something about that.
Well, I imagine there are a lot of women who are listening to us right now who really dread this time of year because every year around this time, every Christian organization is talking about abortion. And I know there are because I've heard from them. There are women who have had abortions who listen to this show and who follow Stand to Reason. And so I also just want to point out that there is forgiveness for you. There is hope. There is Christ's righteousness for you. Obviously, it's horrible to hear to be faced with the truth of your past or what you've done, because none of us wants to do that. And we all have to do that to some extent. And so I just want to make sure people know that there is forgiveness, that the gospel is true. And the only reason why we can face the truth about sin is because we have the gospel. That's what enables us to face the truth. And I just encourage everyone to rest in the gospel, to rest in the fact that Jesus has paid for our sins and that we have his righteousness and that he loves us. In fact, I just want to recommend a book. It's called Gentle and Lowly. And right now I'm blanking on the author. It's an Ortland, but I can't remember which one. I think Dane Ortland. I'm not sure. But it's about Christ's heart for sinners and sufferers is the subtitle, something like that. And it's just, it's very moving to see how he runs towards sinners and how he fully knows everything that we've done and he is there for us. And it's just, it's a beautiful book and I highly recommend it to anyone who is suffering from guilt or any sort of regret about sin in their past. All right. Well, I think that's it. we went a little
well
bit
done,
over.
Well done, Amy. But, that was great. Thank you for your, you had some great insights on that. It was really great. Thank you.
So everyone, thank you for your questions. We always appreciate hearing from you on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.